stand or take whatever posture works best for you in honor of the gospel. Now, on that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem, and talking with each other about these things that had happened. While they were talking and discussing, Jesus himself came near and went with them, but their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And he said to them, "What are you discussing with each other while you walk along?" They stood still, looking sad. Then one of them, whose name was Cleopas, answered him, "Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem? Then what does not know the things that have taken place there these days?" He asked them, "What things?" They replied, "The things about Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet, mighty indeed and word before God and all the people, and how our chief priests and leaders handed him over to be condemned to death and crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. Yes, and besides all of this, it is now the third day since these things took place. Moreover, some women of our group astounded us. They were at the tomb early this morning, and when they did not find his body there, they came back and told us that they had indeed seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they did not see him. Then he said to them, 'Oh, how foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe that all that the prophets had declared. Was it not necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things and then enter into his glory?' Then, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them the things about himself in all the scriptures. As they came near to the village to which they were going, he walked ahead as if they were going on. But they urged him strongly, saying, 'Stay with us, because it's almost evening, and the day is now nearly over.' So he went in to stay with them. When he was at the table with them, he took bread, blessed, and broke it, and gave it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and then he vanished from their sight. They said to each other, 'Were not our hearts burning within us while he was talking to us on the road, while he was opening the scriptures to us?' That same hour, they got up and returned to Jerusalem, and they found the eleven and their companions gathered together. They were saying, 'The Lord has risen indeed, and he has appeared to Simon.' Then they told what happened on the road and how he had been made to known them in breaking the bread." The word of the Lord. And at this time, we're going to dismiss the children to junior worship. Jesus loves me, this I know.
Well, good morning, friends. Thanks, Amelia, for the reading and worship team. Pete, for leading us in song. Margaret, thanks for your prayer. Do you notice that whenever Margaret says good morning, you just feel compelled to shout out good morning? Man, thanks for your prayer and your heart and your reminder about the importance of us engaging God in this way. And thanks for your song. And Brian, thanks for welcoming us into service in such a lovely fashion. Is it just me, or did he have a clip light ready the moment the lights turned off? Oh, I mean, what else is in your pockets? I mean, I was real appreciative Shannon did that. It enhanced the picture greatly. And without a beat, he pulled a clip light out of his pocket. What? That was a great moment. Thank you for that. And thank you for the way you just welcomed us into this space, reminding us we're all welcomed here. Okay, these words for today. While they were discussing these things, Jesus himself came near and walked with them, but their eyes were kept from recognizing him. In 1979, a man by the name of Tom Garvey had a rather outrageous idea, attempting to get back on his feet after his military service in Vietnam. Garvey landed a concession stand job at the now demolished Veterans Stadium in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, former home of the Philadelphia Phillies baseball team and the Philadelphia Eagles football team. As an employee of the stadium, Garvey received a set of keys, one of which opened an out-of-the-way door to a relatively unused storage room. Noticing that no one seemed to be paying any attention whatsoever to the room, Tom Garvey got an idea. Why not convert the space into a one-bedroom apartment? And without asking anyone, that is exactly what he did, quietly converting the unused room into his home. And the extraordinary part is that not a single person noticed. Now, admittedly, Garvey did install a wall of cardboard boxes just inside the door, which is what anyone would have who bothered to open the door would have seen had they opened that door. But behind the wall was an entire living space he created. Garvey brought in a bed, a couch, a table, basic kitchen appliances, and even installed AstroTurf as the carpet in his apartment. And no one, not one single soul, noticed any of it. For hygiene, Garvey utilized the bathrooms in the stadium concourse and the employee showers in the basement. It was, he later told the New York Times, everything a guy could want. Garvey lived in his stadium apartment for nearly 2 years until he'd saved enough money to get a place of his own outside those stadium walls. And amazingly, Garvey was never caught, despite the fact that he spent nearly 24 hours a day for nearly 24 months in that stadium. In fact, we only know of his exploits because he confessed to it all once he had moved out. It was, he said, right in front of their eyes, but they just couldn't believe it. And to be honest, he added, I wouldn't have believed it myself. The disbelief is how I got away with it. How is it possible that everyone could have missed something so utterly outrageous as Tom Garvey living in that stadium for 2 years? Garvey suggests it was because of disbelief. Could that really happen? And perhaps there is some truth to that. But I suspect something much larger is at play here. The very same thing, in fact, that is occurring with our two unsuspecting disciples on the road to Emmaus this morning, for whom the resurrected Christ, like Tom Garvey's living arrangements, remains entirely unseen. Now, we all know how Luke 24 unfolds. Two disciples, hearts weighed down with sorrow, leave Jerusalem to travel the long road of disappointment. We had hoped, they confess, that he was the one, but instead, they crucified him. There are perhaps no more sorrowful words in all of Scripture than that. We had hoped. We had hoped justice would prevail. We had hoped peace would reign. We had hoped love would win. But we were wrong. And now these two souls are headed to Emmaus, a town, by the way, that archaeologists have never actually been able to locate. But no matter, we have no need of a map for this place, for we know that road all too well. It's the road you walk when you've lost in love, in friendship, in faith, in life. Emmaus is the place where you go to escape, as one commentator puts it, a bar, a movie, perhaps simply a room with a closed door. Wherever it is, we throw up our hands and say, forget it. It makes no difference anyway. We know exactly where that road is. Two disciples, hearts weighed down with sorrow, leave Jerusalem and travel the long road of we had hoped. But then Luke does something surprising. He changes the scene entirely by introducing a third character into our story this morning. And all at once, what had began as a tragedy, Luke suddenly shifts into a strange sort of comedy, as Luke lets his audience in on a little secret that those two disciples do not know, namely, the mysterious and seemingly uninformed stranger that they meet on the road, who shows up out of nowhere, is actually, of course, the risen Christ, a fact that our two disciples simply cannot see. And just there, Luke reveals the central question of his comedy, namely, why? Why do we have such difficulty recognizing the risen Christ right here in our own midst? And what could we possibly do about that? Well, to help us think through all of this, to help us think through Luke's question, why do we miss the resurrected Christ so often and what can we do about it? I'd like to take us back for just a moment to the 1990s. Of all the wonders that glorious decade gave us. The Hubble Space Telescope, the dot-com era, Dolly the Sheep, the Good Friday Agreement of Northern Ireland, the dissolution of the Soviet Union, the term multiculturalism, learning that it doesn't count if you don't inhale. The TV show Friends and the show Seinfeld. And, of course, who could forget the single best album of all time, Mac Daddy by Seattle rapper Sir Mix-a-Lot. My daughter and I jam out to it all the time. Not to mention, of course, high school graduations of many people sitting right here in this room. But of all the wonders the 90s have bequeathed to us, perhaps nothing is more pertinent, at least for our purposes, than the work of psychologists Arian Mack and Irvin Rock. But in case those names from the 1990s are not familiar to you, perhaps this little gem of a video will jog your memory. It's a 20-second clip from 1999 that came directly from Mack and Rock's research. I suspect you've probably seen it before, but if not, allow me to introduce it. As you watch, pay close attention. Your only task is this. See if you can count the number of times the group in white jerseys passes their basketball. Got it? Watch it.
How many passes does the team in white make?
Don't move around, just keep watching.
No!
Okay. The answer? 13. Did you get it right? 13. Well done. Now, how about this? Did you happen to notice as well the moon walking bear right in the middle of it? If not, see if you can catch it this time around. Forget the team in white. Watch it one more time.
Go!
According to studies over nearly a decade, over three quarters of us never notice that dancing bear when we watch this video, which is, by all accounts, extraordinary. How could we possibly miss a moonwalking bear? Well, the phrase Ari and Mac and Irvin Rock coined in 1998 to describe this phenomenon is inattentional blindness, a malady, it turns out, I have apparently been suffering from for some time now, at least as long as I've been married. If Lisa ever asks me to find something in the pantry or fridge, I suddenly become incapable of seeing what is right in front of me. And the malady's only magnified when she sends me to the grocery store. I swear Safeway starts hiding things every time they see me coming. And it's not that I don't look. I do. I really do look. But whatever it is she's asked me for is somehow simply invisible to me. Has this ever happened to any of you? And the worst part of it, the absolute worst part of it, is that after I've been standing there like a dope for several minutes in front of the fridge, Lisa will walk up and in exasperation point right to the previously missing mustard or mayonnaise, as if I am an idiot. And every time, I'm dumbfounded. For sure enough, there it is. It, in fact, was there in the fridge to be found, even though I promise it was not there just a moment ago. This, according to Ari and Mac and Irvin Rock, is the result of inattentional blindness. Now, in my defense, I should note, Mac and Rock are quick to clarify that inattentional blindness is not actually a malady, as I've called it. It's merely a normal human aptitude that helps us focus on the details we happen to find most important in this world, which, for the record, never prevents Lisa from rolling her eyes at me nonetheless. Now, the solution that Ari and Mac and Irvin Rock propose for those of us who simply can't find the mustard or Tom Garvey's apartment, for that matter, or perhaps even the resurrected Christ, is what they call vigilant vision, which begins, they suggest, with a confession. Every one of us must begin with a confession, a recognition that just because we cannot currently see something does not mean it's not actually there. A favorite author of mine once overheard two children talking about blindness. One of the kids asked, "How do you know when you are blind?" To which the other one replied, "You don't. You only know afterwards when you can see," which sounds about exactly right to me. But even if we admit that there is more to see than our sight might suggest, how is it that we're supposed to acquire the skills of vigilant vision so we can find the mustard in Tom Garvey's apartment and the risen Christ? I believe this is precisely what Luke is attempting to show us in our passage. For by the end of his story, as you know, as Amelia just read, the hearts of those disciples that were only moments ago burdened with sorrow are all of a sudden burning within, flipped like some switch, and now all of a sudden they can see. And like Tom Garvey's former colleagues, they wonder why they hadn't seen it even sooner. But what, we might wonder, happened to those disciples? How specifically was it that their eyes were finally opened? How did they acquire vigilant vision? Luke, of course, provides an answer for us, but like a bunch of boxes stacked just inside a doorway, the familiarity of this story may well cause us to miss the apartment within the passage, so to speak. Of course, those researchers from the 1990s, Mac and Rock, have suggested a variety of solutions for vigilant vision. But honestly, none of them are entirely satisfactory, amounting to little more than just try harder. But as one who tries very hard to find the coriander in the spice cabinet every time Lisa asks for it, I can tell you trying harder isn't really working for me. And as several subsequent research studies have shown, it's not working for anyone else either. Trying harder is not the only answer. But what then is the answer? How might we learn to really see what needs to be seen? Again, which is, of course, what Luke 24 is ultimately all about. Luke's story this morning is his attempt to tell us how those two disciples managed to acquire vigilant vision. And according to Luke 24, the type of renewed sight like that begins quite simply with this. Three short words that make all the difference in this narrative. And they are menon meth humon, which is Luke's Greek in verse 29 for abide with us. When they came to Emmaus, Luke writes, the unseen disciples urged him strongly, saying, menon meth humon, abide with us. Words brimming with hospitality and welcome. If we had hoped were three words of extraordinary sorrow, abide with us are three words of extraordinary hope in Luke's gospel. The answer to sight, Luke says, begins with welcome. For it was only when those disciples opened their door to that enigmatic man, sat down at the table of hospitality with him, and broke bread that, as Luke says, their eyes were open and they recognized him. In other words, their openness to the unanticipated, unexpected, even the unknown, as this stranger most certainly was, their openness, their hospitality became the means by which they were finally able to see. In other words, vigilant vision, spiritually speaking, begins with open doors and open tables. For the risen Christ, Luke wants us to see, is always, every time, only one welcome away. And while I cannot promise that such an invitation, abide with us, is the key to finally finding the peanut butter in the pantry, according to Luke's gospel, it is the key to finally seeing the risen Christ right here with us. And the implications of that in a world like ours, built as it is around borders and walls and entrenched allegiances, well, the implications of that seem to me to be massive. We simply will not see Jesus. until we are able to say, abide with us to every stranger we meet along the way. Until we are able to say, come, let us break bread together, we will not see Christ. And in so doing, when we invite, we might just discover the gift of finally seeing, perhaps for the very first time, Christ risen right here with us, like an elusive bottle of mustard or a moon-walking bear. If only we will have the eyes to see. If only, that is, we will open our doors and our lives and, by God's manifold grace, say to all of those at our borders, wherever those borders might be in your life, Menon Meth Humon, come, abide with us. Amen.